Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell here today with Russ Chinelli and a special guest. This is a guest who's going to be talking to us about vaccines. We've dealt with this subject before, but this is trying to get a vaccine for a very special disease. It's called Chagas disease. It's one of these things you get from a nasty little parasite. And Russ, who's our guest?
We're very happy to welcome to Science Studio Professor Igor Almeida, Professor in Biological Sciences in the Border Biomedical Research Center. Welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for the invitation. I'm very glad to be here.
And it's at the University of Texas at El Paso is the Border Biomedical Research Center.
Yes, that's right. That's correct, yeah.
Igor, before we get into all this business about vaccines, how do you make them, why do we make them, what's Chagas disease, a little bit about Igor. How did you become a scientist? You're Brazilian.
Yeah.
And I've always assumed every little Brazilian boy wanted to be a Pelé, but perhaps I was wrong.
Well, these days they want to be a Messi, I think.
Yeah, Messi. Messi, but he's Pelé. An Argentinian,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, Argentinian.
No, you
Pope
cannot. Brazilians
well, so.
Do not grow yeah. up wanting to be an Argentinian.
No.
That, I know.
No. Well, I was born in Northeast Brazil, and so in Northeast Brazil, we have this Chagas disease is a major thing. Thousands of people are, in fact, at the time I was a boy, I knew already about Chagas disease because it was the major infection around, beside all the types of parasitic infections.
So love. Even when you were young, you were fascinated by this disease.
Oh, yeah. Even when I was younger, I used to collect, you know, there was this special a magazine bought every month that's called The Scientists. And this magazine brought, every month, brought kind of a box with a set of reagents that you can do experiments. And it was fantastic. You can do experiments at home, you know, in physics, in biology, in chemistry. So wow. When I was about between ages of 10 and 15, I used to buy this every month and do my experiments every week, you know, at home, you know, chemistry, biology, and had a little microscope, you know, to look at, you know, things around the house and bugs and microbes. And
do you remember any of the experiments that you did outstanding in your mind?
Make a flare or something like that? That's what I did, making flares all the time, you know.
I didn't explode anything, but I remember that I was more attracted to the microscope, I think.
Right.
Most of all, to look things under the microscope.
And down in that part of the world, there's a lot of little things crawling around, right?
Yes, a lot
this
of parasites.
Very tropical area.
Yes, a lot of parasites. You know, Brazil, as any other tropical country, is affected by all these types of parasites. And
I mean, it's still true, I think, is it not, that you can go down there and do research and look for parasites and come up with new ones that no one ever knew were there? I mean, there's just an unlimited number
of
yeah, materials.
Well, yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, well, in the case of, you know, Trypanosoma cruzi, this parasite that causes Chagas disease, you know, they're finding new things about the parasite, perhaps a new species of the parasite.
They evolve and adapt when they're attacked?
They adapt, yeah, because, you know, the parasite lives between the wild cycle, called the Sylvatic cycle, and domestic cycle. So it was a parasite only restricted to, you know, the forest, the jungle, and man invaded this environment, these ecosystems. And then the parasite had to adapt to humans, you know. And so now we have, you know, have several genotypes, and there are, you know, different genetic types of this parasite.
But and they all cause the same
They cause the same, well,
people.
More or less the same disease, but the symptoms, the clinical symptoms can be different.
Let's in fact start right there. Yeah. What is Chagas disease?
Okay. Chagas disease is a tropical infection, is a tropical disease caused by Trypanosoma cruzi, which is a single cell parasite. Okay. And it's transmitted by a bug, an insect, popularly known as the kissing bug. And this is a reduvidae parasite that is a hematophagous, it eats blood. It needs to eat blood every It's like a vampire. It needs to eat blood every, more or less, every 2 or 3 weeks. So, and what's interesting about this insect is that it can be found basically any place from the southern U.S. down to the Patagonia.
We have it here in the border, don't we?
Yeah, lots of these insects around. And if you go outside here, you know, don't need to go very far to find these kissing bugs around. And probably half of them.
But they're not always with the parasite.
No.
I mean, they're not always bad for us. Just because you see a kissing bug doesn't mean to say that you're going to be likely to get the disease.
No, not necessarily. Not necessarily, right. Unless you're exposed to the bug's bite.
Right.
So what is very interesting about this bug is that it does not transmit the parasite through the bite, like all other insects do, like the mosquito that transmits malaria or the sandfly that transmits leishmaniasis, which is another major parasitic infection in the world. This bug transmits the parasite through the droplings to the excreta.
Yeah, so, I mean, it bites you and then it defecates.
Defecates. It's a very bad habit, you know.
Yeah.
It eats so much blood. It's about 10 volumes of its body in blood. So it takes about a whole month to digest the whole blood. And the bug has this bad habit of, while eating, to defecate.
Are there other species that do that? I mean,
they do that as well. Mosquitoes also do that.
Defecate and eat at the same time.
Yeah, the only difference is that these parasites adapt to go to infect the host not through the bite of the insect, but through the feces of the insect. So the feces get into the skin, and it can get into the parasite that is there can get into the bloodstream of the host by the bite wound or through exposed mucosa, like oral mucosa or eye mucosa. It's very common that kids get infected through the eye and have this very strong inflammatory reaction. It's called Romanian sign.
So this is how it's spread.
What are the symptoms
of the disease? I mean,
yeah, that's the what is called the natural transmission. But also, in the last, I'd say, 40, 50 years, the natural transmission has been going down in most places because of the very tight campaigns, for very, very strict campaigns for insect control. In Brazil, in Argentina, Paraguay, Uruguay, and other Latin America countries, but Bolivia. Bolivia is a serious issue. So the parasite also can be transmitted by organ transplantation, blood transfusion, and lately, what's interesting, by contaminated foods and fluids, liquids. Like in North Brazil, near the jungle, the Amazon jungle, in big cities like Belém, Manaus, especially Belém, they have had several cases of contamination by juices, acai juice, for instance. Not the acai juice you buy here in the supermarket.
No.
Buy on the street that people have, you know, have very
their own fruit.
Good sanitary conditions, and these fruits can be contaminated with the feces from the bug that contains the
They examine the content because, okay, I got sick and I was drinking, you know, how do they determine whether you got bitten or whether it's...
It's very... The acute phase of the disease, meaning the first 2 weeks of the disease, can be taken as any other infection, like a viral infection or bacterial infection. It's very hard to say. There is not a single symptom sign that say, well, this is Chagas disease. You feel bad and you have a fever. You know, and after a couple of weeks, you're fine again. And so it's very hard to detect the disease in the acute phase, in the first 2 weeks.
So how many people die from it then? So many people just get over it?
Yeah, most people get over, and they stay with the parasites for many years, for even 40, 50 years, and they may die without knowing they ever been infected. And that's the problem for eventual transmission by organ transplant and blood transfusion. So it's why all the blood banks in Brazil and other places in South America, it's mandatory, the screening, the blood screening, because, you know, there's a good chance you get, you know, contaminated if you don't screen the blood.
And in the U.S., we don't currently screen, I understand, or is that
well,
no longer true?
Yeah, well, now we do.
We do.
In the last, since the end of 2007, there have been several cases until early 2000s, and there are several cases of blood contamination, either blood transfusion or organ transplant contamination, that FDA and CDC decided to implement the compulsory screening for Chagas disease in most American blood banks, especially the ones that had a higher risk of a Chagas disease transmission.
I mean, I know, for example, I'm not allowed to give blood because I've lived in England, and therefore there's a chance that I've got this little thing that causes the mad cow disease, right?
Okay,
the wrong prions and all the rest of it. There's no such movement to not take blood from Brazilians because they may be infected.
No, if you do it, the screen is pretty good.
Okay.
You know, it's very effective. You can detect, you know, basically almost all people that have, you know, they've seen the parasite. They have antibodies against the parasite. So it's very effective screening.
So then why is it that some people are subject to being sick when they're infected and others aren't?
That's a big question. That's the question in Chagas disease. Why only 20 to 30% of the patients really develop a disease, symptoms like mainly cardiac complications, and also gastrointestinal complications like megaesophagus or megacolon. And some patients have both cardiac and GI tract complications, which is much more severe. Now, why 70, 80% of the patients, people who are infected with the parasite, do not develop anything? That's a big mystery. But I think there is a consensus that could be due to first of all, the parasite is trained that infected the person. It could be to the host immune response, how you respond to the parasite, how heavy was the initial infection. You know, if you're infected with 1,000 parasite, you're going to have a response that's much more favorable than if you're infected with 1,000,000 parasite cells, for instance. And also the strains, of parasite, they have a big variation in terms of virulence. You know, some strains are very virulent. For instance, the strains that are adapted to the domestic cycle, infecting humans and domestic animals, are usually much more virulent than the strains that are found in the wild. For instance, strains are found in the jungle, in the forest.
You just mentioned animals. So, I mean, this is a parasite that can live in cats and dogs, for example, and get transferred to people at the same time.
Well, the major, for instance, in Texas, in east of Texas, a recent study showed that there have been several studies, in fact, showing that there are many dogs in east of Texas already infected with T. cruzi. Okay, but any domestic animal is prone to be infected with T. cruzi if the bug is around. So usually that happens in the rural areas where the bug can be found in houses. Usually houses that have poor sanitary conditions or, the house is not
well. Does that
mean
that people should worry about their litter boxes and not handle them improperly?
I think they should worry about, if you live in a rural area, you should always look on the walls if you have, like, holes in the walls, because this is where the kissing bug can hide and come out at night.
And do the animals get the disease? Chagas disease.
Oh yeah, because
they have the same symptoms in the end and die of the
dogs,
same.
Dogs do, but this is not well studied because but dogs are well studied and then they have the same symptoms as humans.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name's Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russ Kinnelly and Igor Almeida from the Department of Biological Sciences here at the University of Texas at El Paso, talking about parasites, talking about Chagas disease, how your dog may have Chagas disease. That's a nice thing to be thinking about. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. Most of us are familiar with narcolepsy, when sleep comes on quickly without warning during the day. But we want to tell you about hypersomnia.
It's less known, but also debilitating, because a person can sleep 18 hours and still wake up tired and stay groggy throughout the day.
Researchers believe a possible cause of hypersomnia is a mystery protein, and they've even identified a possible treatment. They worked with people who have normal sleep and those with hypersomnia, comparing their cerebral spinal fluid, which is fluid that surrounds the brain and spinal cord.
Researchers had a hunch that something in the fluid was triggering excessive sleep, kind of the way sedatives work. Take Xanax. It stimulates a sleep receptor called GABA subtype A. When these receptors are stimulated by GABA, brain activity decreases, promoting sleep.
To see if something similar in cerebral spinal fluid of hypersomniacs was overstimulating these GABA receptors, researchers applied the fluid along with GABA to cells in the lab.
The GABA receptor started signaling excessively, twice as much compared to people with normal sleep. This proves that something in their cerebral spinal fluid is triggering chronic sleep.
What's also encouraging is the researchers found a drug to improve symptoms called flumazenil. One woman with a 15-year history of hypersomnia took a pill form of flumazenil for 4 years. Now she sleeps just 8 hours, wakes refreshed, and is back at work.
A large drug trial is needed to make the drug generally available, but hypersomniacs don't want to wait since a kiss from a prince is awfully hard to come by.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Kinelli, Igor Almeida from the Biological Sciences Department at UT El Paso. We're talking about Chagas disease, and we're talking about the fact that it exists in animals, too, and from the same particular nasty little parasite. Which leads us to the question, then. You can presumably do lots of studies on this parasite in animal models. It's not so easy to do it on human models. Can we apply the model study of animals to understanding the disease in humans?
Oh, yes. The animal model, especially the mouse model, has been used for many years already, in the last, I'd say, 40, 50 years.
And this is one of the cases where people can't come along and say, but that's what you found in a mouse,
yes.
But it doesn't apply to people.
That's correct, yeah.
So this is a much better model for us in this case.
Yeah, so it's a very good model, but it's not human. So,
no.
But, for doing the basic research and understanding how the parasite, in fact, keeps the infection chronic in mammals, mouse is a fantastic model. In many ways, it's
very similar. Is this a model you're using? Tell us specifically about your research.
Yeah. So in my research, for instance, where we have been using an animal model that mimics very closely the human response against this parasite.
Is this mice?
It's a mouse. It's a mouse model.
Yeah,
and
okay.
It's a special type of mouse. It has one single gene removed from the animal.
This is a so-called knockout mouse.
Knockout, yeah, exactly. It's a mutant, it's a knockout animal. One gene was deleted, and this animal, what's interesting is that it makes a immune response in terms of antibodies, which are, the major humoral response against, pathogens. We have two types of immune response against pathogens. One is the humoral response. It's given by antibodies, which is these proteins that can recognize the pathogen and kill the pathogen by, different ways, or tag the pathogen to be killed by immune cells like macrophages. And you have the immune response that's given by the cells, like T cells, for instance, that also can lead to the killing of the pathogen.
That's an interesting point in general. You have a pathogen. Do both of these methodologies always function, or is it just one? You've got a particular pathogen, it's just T-cell, or is there another one?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So in case of T. cruzi, we know that both B-cells that produce antibodies and T-cells that produce the...
For HIV, for example, it's primarily T-cells, right?
HIV is T-cell.
Yeah.
Well, but let me take it back. HIV also antibodies may play a very important role, in fact. Lately, they have been trying to developing antibodies that can kill HIV. In fact, in many cases, virus can be targeted by antibodies.
Okay.
And bacteria as well. So in the case of Chagas infection, both the antibodies and T-cell mediated immunity given by cytotoxic T-cells that can destroy infected cells play a very important role in Chagas disease. The problem with the regular animal model that has been used so far in Chagas disease studies is that this animal model does not see the major antibody response against the parasite. Now, using this knockout animal, one single gene that's deleted from the mouse genome, we see both the response provided by antibodies and provided by T cells. So this is the model we have been using.
How does knocking out this gene accomplish that? That's
well, that's accomplished at the level of the a single cell. So before, you do in a single cell, like you do genetic modification in one single cell before reproductive cell, okay?
So let me ask this question. Knocking out this gene that makes the mouse more responsive, I mean, what is the purpose of doing that, and how was it discovered?
Exactly. So, it was discovered that, the discovery was not made in the Chagas disease model, but an investigator from the U.S., Yuri Galili, I think he was interviewed by you some years ago. So he discovered that humans have these very high levels of this antibody called anti-Gal antibody. This antibody recognizes a single carbohydrate in pathogens, specifically in bacteria. So all humans, they have very high levels of this anti-Gal. And then Uri developed, and not Uri per se, but all the investigators working with these anti-Gal antibodies, which are very important for the acute rejection of xenotransplant. For instance, many years ago, people had this idea that to use pig organs to transplant to humans because they're very similar in shape, in everything, to humans. But when you do the experimental analysis of these organs to see if the human immune system can tolerate these tissues from pig, they found that the human cells, immune cells, reject these organs very, very fast. It's a very strong acute rejection. And Galili was the one who found that the anti-Gal antibodies were responsible for this rejection. So then they had the idea of generate a pig that was transgenic, that didn't have this gene that expressed this epitope, this single sugar.
And then we have all the cells and all the little replacement parts we needed.
Yes, that's right. Cells that from pigs that didn't have this epitope, this single sugar that caused the rejection. So they tried to do it in the pigs. But the problem is that for pigs, for the fertilization process, the alpha-Gal, the sugar epitope, is absolutely critical for fertilization. So the colony of pigs or transgenic pigs didn't go, very far. And then they had the idea, why not, do the same in mouse, at least to understand how this whole thing works.
Right.
And then we found that things happen inside serendipity, right, that the parasite has exactly the same epitope as we found in pigs and other mammals, but humans.
I mean, chemically, actually the same.
Exactly the same. Have a trisaccharide. Yeah. It's three sugars together. Uh-huh. And the end of this three sugars, there is one epitope that is one single sugar that's very immunogenic to humans. And it's the same sugar that pigs express in their tissues, that mice express in their tissues, rabbits and other mammals, but humans. And old world monkeys like chimpanzees and gorillas.
We're all related.
Yeah. So then you realize that this epitope in the parasite was responsible for a very strong immune response by people who are infected with T. cruzi, and they make antibodies against this single sugar. And these antibodies they can kill the parasite and control the infection. And now we can use the mouse model to analyze, to evaluate the response given by this antibody against the parasite.
So that leads us then on to the $64 million question. I mean, mostly people like the idea of when they're little children, you get a shot, you're immunized, you're vaccinated, and you're never going to get this particular disease or that. Are we now in a position to be able to think about serious vaccine development?
I have been working with Chagas disease since my PhD in 19. I started my PhD in 1990, and since then I have been working with this parasite, and particularly in the carbohydrate, the importance of carbohydrate sugars,
right,
in the response against the parasite. And there are not many people working with that because sugars are very complicated to work with. Most people work with proteins and DNA and but sugar is much more complex in terms of
and very difficult to synthesize a particular series.
Exactly.
Very tough.
So I've been working with this. First of all, we try to identify which molecules in the parasites were the target for these antibodies that could kill the parasite, and then we identify the molecule by structural analysis, doing a lot of chemistry and other types of structural analysis, and then we now. In the last 8-9 years, we have been working this vaccine that targets these sugar epitopes in the parasite. And for that, we use this knockout animal. In the last 4 or 5 years, we have having very, very promising results. And lately, in fact, we got even more promising results that we can block the infection. We can control the infection in animals that are infected.
So it's not just a prophylactic. It's actually a treatment.
Yeah, we can transfer these antibodies to animal that's already infected, and you can somehow control the infection. But
all right,
the control is more effective if you give before the infection. So in this case, you know, if you use as a prophylactic vaccine, we get 100% protection in these animals, even when they are exposed to very high doses of the parasite.
So what's the next step? I mean, you're going to have some clinical trials beyond the
That's the idea. That's the idea. Where before the clinical trials in humans, which that is going to take many years and also mainly a lot of money for developing any vaccine these days, the cost is around $800 million to $1 billion, more or less.
$1 billion?
Yeah, $1 billion for most vaccines and drugs right now. So that's the major issue, I think. However, we keep going, and next step would be to test this, this vaccine that's working very nicely in this special mouse model we have that mimics the human infection, to test this in non-human primates. As you know, Texas has a fantastic institute, this non-human primate center in San Antonio, and they have all sorts of non-human primates from Africa and Asia.
Right.
And these primates, non-human primates, they respond to T. cruzi infection, Trypanosoma cruzi infection, the same way as humans do, okay? Because they do not have this special sugar in their cells.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they are not tolerant to this sugar, so they make a response that's very similar to humans.
So once you start those studies, and presumably you're starting
we have established a collaboration.
Right.
Now we're applying for grants, which is another issue,
right,
as you know. And if you are funded, we're going to start, you know, these vaccinations in non-human primates soon.
What's the time period for knowing whether or not this is a promising?
Well, maybe in the next 2 years or so.
2 years. Yeah, it's relatively short.
Yeah,
that
relatively
particular
short,
part. It's just when you do the studies in humans,
yes,
with all the protections that you need,
yeah,
that's,
you know,
will be more complex.
Yeah, if you go for then going to human trials, that's going to take at least, you know, 5 to 10 years, depending on the funding. The availability.
You mentioned that Chagas disease from this particular parasite, you know, from all the way from Patagonia, well, north of the Patagonia down to the southern part of the U.S., that implies some sort of climatic feature. It doesn't do well in cold climates?
Well.
And why only in Central America? Don't they have something similar in Africa or in India,
but
different names?
Well, the disease is restricted, naturally restricted to the American continent, especially Latin America, from Mexico, northern Mexico, down to, in fact,
would it be possible
the south,
to
south
infect,
of Argentina.
Do you think we could infect Africa or some other place with a similar climate?
Well, that's what we're going to get. The disease now became global because of the big migrations
travel
we have.
Right.
Globalization is good, but also could be bad in terms of you could spread disease that are restricted to certain places to other places.
Yeah.
We found, for instance, Chagas disease patients in Australia now. In Alaska.
Igor, it's been a pleasure having you here on Science Studio.
Yes, Igor, thanks very much. And I hope that your wonderful research can get to help people a little more quickly. Then, thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
And thank you all for listening. Science Studio, the highlight of your week, we know that. That's why we try our hardest to get you interesting programs. And we'll be back next week. Take care. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. Robert Kirkin has been appointed Dean of the College of Science at UTEP. The decision came on the heels of a national search to fill the position. Since 2005, Kirkin has served as Chair and Professor of the Department of Biological Sciences. He is also Program Director of UTEP's $13 million NIH-sponsored Border Biomedical Research Center. Read more at mcasynapse.org.